This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Farside by Ben Bova. This book is read by Stefan Rudnicki. To dearest Rashida, who is not only a knockout artist, but a lifesaver. My heartfelt thanks to Peter Weringer of the Steward Observatory, University of Arizona, for his kind and unfailing help. Character determines destiny. Heraclitus of Ephesus, circa 500 BC.
Yes, we, said Mira. We killed the savages' bulls, and the drunkards' bulls, and the riau-riau dancers' bulls. Yes, we killed them. We killed them all right. Yes, yes, yes.
Ernest Hemingway. Lobber. Trudy Yost was understandably nervous as the ballistic rocket hurtled high above the barren pockmarked lunar plain. The liftoff had been a shock. Trudy had dutifully strapped herself into her seat and lowered it back to the full reclining position as instructed in the safety lecture that played on the screen set into the passenger compartment's overhead paneling. Then the rocket engines had lit off, and the ship hurtled off its launch pad with a deafening roar and bone-rattling vibration. The launch from Earth had been much gentler, and she assumed that a liftoff in the moon's light gravity would be just as easy. Something's gone wrong, Trudy thought. The G-force pushed her down into the reclined seat like a ton of cement on her chest, and it wouldn't stop. She thought of the earthquake she'd experienced in Palo Alto when she'd been a grad student. It went on and on, the whole world shaking and grinding, the dorm building swaying like a ship in a typhoon. Afterward, she was told that the tremor had lasted 78 seconds, but it sure felt like hours. The rocket engines stopped abruptly, leaving Trudy's ears ringing and her arms floating off the seat's armrests. Her stomach crawled up into her throat. She swallowed bile and swore to herself that she would not upchuck. The pilot's grinning face appeared on the overhead screen. "Well, we're well and truly launched. We'll be at Farside in 32 minutes. Almost as an afterthought, he added, "You can crank your seats up now and enjoy the view." Carefully, Trudy raised her seat. She swallowed again and told herself that she'd experienced zero gravity on the flight up from Earth, and there was absolutely no reason why she should get sick from it now. Besides, there was this awesome hunk of a guy in the seat across the aisle from her, and she'd be damned to hell and back if she was going to make an ass of herself in front of him. He was smiling at her. Quite a takeoff, wasn't it? Trudy nodded weakly. These ballistic flights, he said. They slam on all the power at liftoff, and then let the bird coast the rest of the way. No atmosphere to worry about. We just fly along an arc like an old-time artillery shell. He's an Adonis, Trudy thought. Handsome, chiseled features. Sparkling light brown eyes. Thick, dark hair long enough to tickle the collar of his expensive-looking jacket. Good broad shoulders, flat midsection. The kind who never looks at mousy little me, she told herself. And here I'm wearing this drab old pullover and jeans. Should have dressed better. Should have thought of looks instead of comfort. It took an effort for her to find her voice. The ship looks like the clipper ships they use on Earth, only kind of smaller.
Most of the clippers back Earthside are manufactured here on the moon, at Cellini. They use nanomachines to build them out of carbon dust. Soot gets turned into diamond structure, thanks to nanotechnology.
Trudy knew that. Everybody knew that. But this hunk of a stud was talking to her as if he were a professor and she a freshman. I thought the liftoff would be easier, she said. Gentler. What with the moon's lower gravity. He shook his head. No, they blast off at 4 G's. Then coast. Here on the moon they call these ships lobbers. They just lob them up and out, like artillery shells.
Yes, you told me that.
He smiled at her, teeth dazzling bright. So I did. Then he extended a hand across the narrow aisle. My name's Carter McClintock. His hand engulfed hers.
Trudy Yost.
He cocked his head. Trudy?
Is that short for Gertrude?
No, Trudy snapped. Everybody thinks that. My parents named me Trudy. It's on my birth certificate.
Okay, okay. He released her hand, then asked, So what brings you to Farside?
I'll be doing my postdoc work there, under Professor Ulrich.
Oh, you're the astronomer, said McClintock, looking impressed. The professor's new assistant.
I'll be working with him on the optical interferometer. We're going to image Sirius C.
He nodded uncertainly.
That's the Earth-sized planet that was discovered about 10 years ago, Trudy explained.
The one they call New Earth, right?
Right. It's about 2.5 parsecs from us, and it...
Parsecs?
3.26 light-years. It's the distance an object would be if it showed a parallax of 1 arc-second. Parallax, second, parsec.
Oh. Yes, I see. He leaned his chair back slightly and turned his attention to the overhead screen.
Stupid, 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 Trudy raged at herself. Here you've got this hunk chatting with you, and you bury him in jargon. Why do you have to show everybody how smart you are? It's stupid. You just drive them away.
For several moments, she sat rigidly in her chair, staring at the display screen, which showed the lunar landscape sliding by far beneath them. The Lobber's passenger compartment was only half full, 6 men and women heading for Farside. Consciously refraining from biting her lip, Trudy turned back to McClintock and asked,
And why are you going to Farside?
I work there, same as you're going to, he said, brightening slightly.
You're an astronomer?
He flashed that knockout smile again. No, I'm in management. I work with Professor Ulrich, help him with administrative matters.
Oh, said Trudy, glowing inside. I guess we'll see a lot of each other then.
I imagine we will.
Data Bank. By the second half of the 21st century, astronomers had detected several thousand planets orbiting other stars. Most of these exoplanets were gas giants, bloated spheres of hydrogen and helium, totally unlike Earth. But a few percent of them were small, rocky worlds, more like our own. One in particular raised hopes of being really Earth-like, Sirius C. It was almost the same size as Earth, and although its parent star was a fiercely blazing blue-white giant, much larger and hotter than the Sun, the planet's orbit lay at the Goldilocks distance from Sirius, where its surface temperature was not too hot and not too cold for liquid water to exist. On Earth, liquid water means life. Beneath the frozen iron sands of Mars, liquid water melting from the permafrost hosts an underground biosphere of microbial life forms. In the ice-covered seas of Jupiter's major moons, living organisms abound. In the planet-girdling ocean beneath the eternal clouds of giant Jupiter itself, life teems and flourishes. Sirius C was a challenge to the astrobiologists. It couldn't possibly bear life, Goldilocks notwithstanding, not sandwiched between brilliant Sirius A and its dwarf star companion Sirius B. The dwarf had erupted in a series of nova explosions eons ago. The death throes of Sirius B must have sterilized any planets in the vicinity. But there it was, a rocky Earth-sized planet, the only planet in the Sirius system orbiting Sirius A in a nearly perfect circle. Might there be a chance that the planet did harbor some kind of life forms? The astrobiologists worked overtime concocting theories to support the hope that the Earth-sized planet might indeed host an Earth-type biosphere. The popular media had no such problem. They quickly dubbed Sirius C New Earth. Orbiting in a zone where water could be liquid did not necessarily mean that Sirius C actually had liquid water on its surface. Astronomers all across Earth and on the Moon strove to discover water, oxygen, other clues to the presence of life on the exoplanet. Detecting the planet was not the same as imaging it. Sirius C was discovered by the minute gravitational tugs it exerted on its parallel.